From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we discuss the challenges of dealing with gang violence in Boston and some possible solutions.
When these guys get to where they need to get, it's just an amazing feeling knowing that you can change your life or just help somebody, just change their mindset.
Also today, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner on two big cases decided by the Supreme Court. And are criticisms over Women's World Cup celebrations overblown?
It's not so long ago that nobody knew anything about the Women's World Cup. And I think part of the celebrations is people just celebrating the fact that it's come a long way.
Last, world champion whistling. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We want to start today with a conversation about gang life and leaving gangs in Boston. It is a complicated issue with a lot of ground to cover, so we are going to dive right in. To do that, we're joined in studio by Talia Rivera. She's a Boston native that has founded and worked for a number of nonprofits focused on dealing with gang involvement in the city. Talia, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also here with us is Mark Culleton, CEO of College Bound Dorchester, which runs Boston Uncornered, a program that provides guidance, mental health supports, and financial assistance for gang members to go to college. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. Talia, I'm going to start with you. You've done a lot of work dealing with both youth violence and gang intervention. You co-founded Villages Without Walls. You've done work brokering truces between gangs. Can you tell us a bit about the current state of gang activity in Boston? Are things getting better or worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. I think it depends on who you ask. I sat in the mayor's summer safety meeting that happened a few weeks back. And some of the data that they shared is that the violence that's happening, most of the perpetrators and some of the victims are not young people, right? So they're not this 15 to 18-year-old anymore. It's more so adults in their late 20s to early 30s.
Interesting.
So when you see that data, you think, well, something's working, right? That you don't see children, teenagers anymore as active. But I think it looks different. I haven't been on the ground in a little while. Mm-hmm. So when I was on the ground, it was very visible. Guys on corners, hanging out. Now it's a lot more sporadic, right? It's all over the place. It's not like defined or confined to a corner anymore. So if I happen to see you and I'm from H Block and you happen to be in Lynn, right, living mm-hmm. with your baby's mom, I'm going to get you out there. So I think it's just a lot more spread out. So it looks a little different and a little harder to contain.
Less concentrated, pervasive.
Yeah.
So maybe a little harder to visually identify.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. So if you've got older young men that are engaged,
yep.
that's a trajectory of life where gang activity has been part of their lives for a while. What does it take to truly change the trajectory of the life of a young person who's been that deeply involved for that kind yeah. of time?
Investments, I think.
What kind of investments?
Opportunities, opening doors for them, whether that be employment, whether that's through education. But figuring out ways to create spaces for them to do something different. Mm-hmm. You see programs like College Bound Dorchester, Inner City Weightlifting, that are doing phenomenal work, opening doors for young people who typically would not be in college and or personal trainers. So I think it's creating opportunities for them.
In college being College Bound Dorchester,
absolutely.
Personal trainers being inner city
weightlifting.
This is a great place to bring you in, Mark. College Bound Dorchester has been running this Boston Uncornered program for about 3 years. How did you decide that this was the best approach? You picked a very specific approach here, combining education and financial assistance. How'd you get there?
Really, by trying to answer the question of how can you use education as a means to transform community. So we invest in gang-involved young people and adults because we love them and know that they can and will be great, but more importantly, what they can do for the community. And so, I mean, I think we've done great things in the city of Boston in terms of combating gang violence and working with the city, with the police department, community groups, certainly have informed the nation. But still, every year there are about 200 shootings, about 50 homicides in this very small group of 3,500 individuals, maybe 1,200 families.
Out of a population of, what, 600,000 people in the city of Boston.
But, so you have to think of that, those shootings reverberating throughout that, really, like you think of a 3,500-person small town in Western Massachusetts, there were 200 shootings, it would be an endemic problem. That's happening sort of under the radar in Boston. And these guys don't want to be in it. These men and women want way out. As Talia said, you want to get close to them and give them opportunity. And when you do that, they choose to do different things. More often than not, you're born into a gang. You're born into a gang lifestyle. And if given an opportunity, if we have the courage as a city, as individuals, to get close to, love, and support these young people, they will change, and that will change our city.
So, Mark, both of you have said, okay, open doors, create opportunity. Young people who are gang involved will want to walk through. Yet we also know PTSD, trauma, maybe low school attendance, truancy, family tragedy and abuse. We know that these can be characteristics of young people who are gang involved. So what challenges do you face when you bring a young person into the program? There have got to be social emotional needs, educational readiness questions, et cetera.
Yeah. So one thing I will say is we have never in the history of College Bound or Boston Uncornered have had a young person who's not been able to make it because of academic issues. Smart,
capable. I got to tell you, I'm surprised about that. And not because I don't believe in the population, but because so many other programs, I mean, even adult basic education programs I used to be engaged in, readiness was always an issue. So is it because of who you're picking?
Well, it's because we go after the most influential gang leaders in the city intentionally because of their impact on their crews and therefore the city.
And are they the ones you're extracting, or are you talking letting peripheral players go?
Well, that's the ones that we're focused on, that we're stipending because of their impact on their crew. These tend to be many of them dropped out at 16 or 15 and have a ninth grade education, but incredibly bright, hardworking, driven individuals that they need a lot of academic support. But there's a lot of post-secondary pathways where they can excel, and they do excel. The biggest challenge is obviously, I think, and Talia probably is far more knowledgeable than me on
Talia,
this.
Talia, just so you know.
Talia, sorry.
No problem.
I keep saying Talia, sorry. That's okay. That's my French pronunciation. I'm going with it. This idea of trust and being vulnerable and asking for help. And so if you can get young people to that place or gang-involved young people to have a little bit of trust, have a little bit of ability to show vulnerability, to ask for help, they can do anything. And that's the heart of the problem. And you have to build a model and support system that acknowledges that they will fail multiple times on the path to trust. And you have to have super high expectations and super low requirements. Any requirements will be failed and they'll be kicked out. But since our nexus is community change, we keep them in, and many of the best programs do exactly that same thing.
Yeah, Greg Croteau from UTEC, you'll hear him say, we're not a second chance organization, we're an eighth, ninth, tenth chance organization.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I've got a person we want to bring in on the phone in just a minute, but first, Talia, I'm going to come back to you for a second. Traditionally, people who do outreach with gangs are called street workers, and Mark has talked about this really important factor of trust. Yep. So how does one build trust in street work?
Yeah. This is so simple but profound. I mean, the way that I did that is I would show up to the neighborhood where I was assigned, and I would say, hey, what's up? I'm a street worker. How you doing? If you need anything, let me know. And I'll walk away, but I come back the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day until they say, you know what, actually, I'm going to court. Do you think that you can come with me?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just being consistent, really.
And really, how many next days are we talking about?
Lots of next days.
Yeah.
Sometimes it depends. Sometimes 30, you know, sometimes 40.
Yeah. I want to bring another voice in on this. Joining us now on the line is Michal Chamberlain. He's the Massachusetts president of Bank of America. Michal, you guys have been financial partners in this program. First, let me just welcome you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was cranking. I jumped right in on a question, but I did want to say
hello.
I want to start by asking you about Boston's approach in dealing with gang activity, gang violence, gang involvement. What do you feel needs to change either in our attitudes or our policy approach in order to make real progress?
Well, look, I think it's up to the business community to roll up their sleeves and get involved in any way they can to help these organizations that are focusing on this population that, frankly, you know, the city needs as to be productive members of our society. I mean, if you look at the unemployment rate here in Boston being now under 3%, and when I sit around board tables with other CEOs and presidents, we're all longing for a more diverse talent pool, and it's certainly right here in our community. So for us, you know, we think partnering with an organization like College Bound Dorchester, it gives these kids an opportunity to get off the street, to get educated, and again, get on the pathway to economic success. And that's money well spent and time well spent for our organization.
So, Michal, you talked about it's important for all businesses to roll up their sleeves and get involved. You know, we know the arc of corporate social responsibility investments, and one of the first things that is necessary is brand return. So given that, and, you know, Bank of America's interest as a financial institution in the city, what makes Boston Uncornered a good investment for you?
Well, look, I think we all as business people also want a return on that investment, that ROI. And when you go through the results that Mark and his team are putting up, I think it's pretty impressive. I mean, the one that jumped off the page to us right away was really, if you look at formerly gang-involved youth associated with Boston Uncornered, they're matriculating to college at a 70% ratio or 70% rate, as opposed to the national average of this population of just 1%. So if we can impact, again, the highest impact people in these gangs, the core influencers, if we can get them off the streets and get some of their friends to follow, ultimately, you know, that number of 70% is only going to get higher. So you're three years into a program. We think as more people come through this program, it has the opportunity really to have a bit of a domino effect, and people will see the success that these young core influencers are having, no longer on the streets, but in boardrooms and in companies around the city.
Michal, I'm going to ask you one more question, only because we've got so many topics I want to make sure we get in here. Reverend Eugene Rivers, who is a co-founder of the Boston 10-Point Coalition, was asked about the dip in crime rates last year, and he told the Globe that Boston is morphing into a boutique town, saying that part of the decrease in crime comes from gentrification. He says crime will decline because numbers of the poor will decline. How is Bank of America thinking about this question of gentrification in the city and the changing demographics of the city as you guys think about how to invest?
Yeah, look, I'd answer it like this, Tiziana. You know, we have a third of our financial centers in LMI neighborhoods. And if you look at whether it be in Dorchester, Mattapan, et cetera, Codman Square, we have recently remodeled some of these branches because we think it's important to help people in these communities develop the credit score, learn how to manage their money through our program called Better Money Habits. And for us, if we make these investments, this isn't about gentrification. It's about putting people on a pathway to success. And if they do it via education, that's the place we think it starts. And that's why we continue to invest in College Bound Dorchester and other organizations like it.
That's Michal Chamberlain, Massachusetts president of Bank of America. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, I want to hear now, I've got some tape from one of your college readiness advisors. We spoke earlier with Elias Perea. He's 41 years old, a former gang member, and he talked with me about how his own history actually makes it possible for him to connect with the program's participants in a meaningful way.
I know how I could work with these people, that, you know what I mean, the students that I work with in the community, because I came from the community. And it's hard to leave the community because everybody's around you, there's going. A lot of friends, old friends are still gang involved. A lot of family members that I know that, you know, that they were gang involved, but, you know, they're around, but they're happy that I make a change, you know.
When you bring a young person who is gang involved into the program, what is their reaction like at first, and does it change over time?
Well, a lot of it comes with their mindset and their willingness and their readiness. Like how, for instance, they grow out of it, either they age or some of them just are confused and scared of the new challenge. And that's the face that you know, I try to like to work with them on that, you know.
What do you think is kind of the most important support that they need during that time of fear and transition? What do you really focus on making sure you're providing them?
Well, one of the trust and their safety, you know, that's the most important.
You come from a life where you were involved in a gang. You come from the community that you serve now. How important is that credibility to your ability to do the work and to connect with young people and invite them to different choices in their lives?
That comes from, you know, just like I said, the trust, and they know that I have a background like that, and that I made a change. That they look up to people that, you know, like, okay, for instance, that they made it, you know what I mean? Like, they want to make it too. So some people don't have nobody like a mentor or nobody to look up to say, oh, yo, show me a way. And that's what I'm here for.
When you were a really young man, if somebody had approached you and been able to convince you to make a change sooner than you did, what would you needed to have heard and what would they need to have been able to tell you for you to make that change sooner than you did?
Like our students now, it is the financial problem a lot. And like nobody came at me like, yo, we'll help you out on the financial part. And that's where we come in. And the support, like they're constantly on, like being on their back or on my back. I would appreciate it, you know, showing that effort, that love. You know?
Mm-hmm. And Elias, one last question. If there happens to be a young person who's gang involved, who's listening to you right now, what's the one most important thing you'd say to them?
That there's more than life than a gang. You know what I mean? I mean, I know that you try to say like, okay, this is my family. This is all I know, but there is more. There's, you know, you can travel, you know, to be a leader to your family, be a leader to your community. And that's it. There's more to life.
Talia, you reacted. I saw you react so strongly when he talked about the financial component. Yeah. What was on your mind? What were you thinking?
Yeah, I was thinking, I wish somebody would pay me to go to school. I probably would have graduated.
Right?
Yeah. No,
that's what the data says.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, I feel like for me, you know, growing up in a household with a mom who was addicted to crack, I had to figure out how to fend for myself, right? So I decided to sell drugs. But if there were programs like College Bound Dorchester or an opportunity like Villages Without Walls that said, hey, let me hire you to be a community organizer and pay you, I would have been all over that.
So, Mark, you know, I got to believe there are people who are skeptical about the payment thing.
Yep.
So, I mean, obviously, Talia has just handed you another great argument.
Right.
But what is the case that you make? Because we know this. People are very skeptical about the idea that you put payment directly into the hands of young people who are struggling with poverty, criminal justice, et cetera.
Right. Well, the first thing I say to those folks who have real questions about that is that we currently spend in the Commonwealth $100,000 per gang member per year. So we're paying them already. We're paying them for police, for the courts, for incarceration. So we're already spending a significant amount investment, $100,000, and that $100,000 buys another $100,000. Over the course of a lifetime, a gang member will cost the Commonwealth $1 million. So we're talking about a third of that. That changes them immediately from a negative force to a positive force in their community.
So let me tell you the thing, though, that's floating. Yep. I got to tell you the thing that's niggling at me.
Go for it.
I know that a lot of the young men in the program are going into community college.
Yep.
In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Ed Reform Now has some data that says that at best, Black students in community college in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts have a 15% graduation rate in 3 years.
Yep.
Are we saddling these young men with student debt, student obligations, and low performance rates because of the systemic issues in our community college system? You got great numbers of them going in. But what about coming out? You know that's a concern.
Yeah, so we have a 70% retention rate, and that travels through to graduation, too.
I mean, you're getting early. 70% graduating over
exactly.
What period of time?
Over 3 years.
That's
over
a striking number.
Yeah, it's striking. But we're investing because when they go to community colleges, their mentor goes with them. So it's not – the community college system has resources, has – advisors, has tutoring. The problem is that the ones that need it don't take advantage of it. And the ones that take advantage of it don't necessarily need it. So for that 15%, the community colleges work. The challenge is the ones that get there and don't have direction, advice, guidance to get to those resources, struggle, and fail out. And so what we've said is that we have to go with our young people. We have to take them to tutoring. We have to take them and make sure they're in front of the right professors that really care and understand them. So our rates are significantly higher than national rates for college going in general because we're investing in staying close. And that trust thing, they trust these guys, so they'll ask for help. They won't ask for help from a stranger because you don't want to be vulnerable.
To a stranger.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a skill.
So I want to get one last very short, like 20-second question into Leah. Yep. This is all reaction to young men already in gangs. What's the big prevention lever?
The big prevention lever?
How do we prevent them from getting involved in the first place?
Opportunities.
Yeah. Economic, yeah. Educational.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
And on that note, that is Mark Culleton, CEO of College Bound Dorchester. Mark, I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you so much.
And to Leah Rivera, a Boston native who has founded and worked for a number of nonprofits focused on dealing with gang involvement in the city. To Leah, thanks so much to you as
well.
Thank you. All right, stay with us. Coming up, Nancy Gertner joins us to talk about the implications of two major Supreme Court cases. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have breaking news this hour out of Boston Federal Court. Judge Talwani has handed down a preliminary injunction that stops civil arrests by ICE in and around courthouses in Massachusetts. With us is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
We had called you today to talk about a couple of big decisions of the Supreme Court, which we will. But before we get to those, can you talk about the significance of this ruling in the federal court here?
Well, I mean, this is as far as I know, the only injunction of its kind. That is to say,
in
the country, as far as I know. And so the notion, what they're saying is that a civil detainer from ICE is really nothing more than a request to hold someone. It's not signed by a judge. It doesn't follow a legal proceeding. It essentially doesn't have much of a force of law. And what she's saying is that you may not use that to arrest anyone in and around the courthouses. That's not just in the courtroom. The Massachusetts state courts have said you may not execute these civil detainers in the courtroom. This is courthouse. And my understanding, that's right. And my understanding is that that goes further than policies across the country. The bedrock of the decision, or at least of the arguments, was that there was essentially a common law right to be free from these kinds of arrests in courtrooms, in courthouses and courtrooms.
So this is really interesting because actually the people who filed the suit were actually DAs, Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan and Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. They said that their ability to uphold basically other laws is compromised when immigrants interfere, fear going to court. But Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson has called it a frivolous lawsuit. So where do you come down on
that? Well, it can't be too frivolous because the judge, in order to issue a preliminary injunction, has to make two findings. One is the likelihood of success on the merits. So she has to say, what you have shown me already suggests that you're going to ultimately win. That suggests it's not frivolous.
By definition.
Right. And then in addition, that you will be irreparably harmed unless I enter this injunction. And they made a showing that witnesses, people complaining about domestic violence, all the sort of day-to-day currency of a courthouse would be affected if people who are undocumented know that ICE is lurking. The business of the court would be undermined if ICE is lurking.
So, but what about the idea that the business of law enforcement would be undermined if this interferes with their ability to arrest people who are in the country illegally as long as they're in sort of this really protected sphere?
Right. But, you know, the way to look at it, it's like the story of an animal blind, which is that you're hiding behind a tree and wait until
this
the animals
hunters.
Come up. Right, right. Until they come up to feed. What they've done is the courthouse is essentially a protected space. And the ICE has the ability to arrest people outside in the public spaces. Mm-hmm. Why should we give ICE the advantage to take advantage of people who are there for other purposes? ICE is simply saying you may not go ahead in this space, but you can do it across the street. Mm-hmm. You can do it next door. You can do it in other spaces, but not when people who are coming here for one set of purposes to have them arrested for another set of purposes.
Why should we give ICE the advantage to take advantage?
That's
really
right.
Sticks
That's
with
right.
me. Okay, well, but WBUR is going to be following this story. I do want to ask you some of what we actually
right.
had you come
oh,
here
yes.
to talk
oh,
about.
Yes.
So I want to talk about the decisions of the Supreme Court in Washington today, starting with the case of Gundy versus the United States. They ruled 5-3 with liberal justices plus a concurring opinion from Judge Alito. Judge Kavanaugh recused himself. The actual case, the case involved a lurid crime in the sex offender registry, but what gives it sort of broader relevance is a question of how much power Congress can delegate to government agencies. And just to be clear, in this case, the question was whether Congress was right in their decision to delegate details of enforcement of the sex offender registry to the Attorney General. That sounds pretty internecine, but what are the implications of this decision? Why does it matter so much?
Well, the issue that went up was the question of whether or not the Attorney General, whether it was appropriate to delegate this authority to the Attorney General. And the general principle is Congress has the power to legislate, and Congress cannot delegate what is essentially its constitutional legislative authority to executive agencies. That's the sort of broad question. The majority says that this was not an inappropriate delegation. Congress set the parameters of what the Attorney General could do. The Attorney General was effectively carrying out the details, determining the extension of registration when it was feasible.
And the court was saying it's okay for the Attorney General to be responsible
for
the
right.
details.
That's right. Because you can imagine a situation where you don't want the legislative authority, the legislature that is multivariate and, you know, composed of people all around the country to be, you know, to be essentially doing what is the people's work. But for, you know, years and years and years and decades, Congress legislates somewhat generally, and mm-hmm. you delegate to administrative agencies to carry it out.
And I want to get to that, because there was at least some significant concern before this ruling came out that there was the potential here, and I'll use a term I've heard you use, to defang or dismantle the administrative state.
Right,
How
right.
so?
Well, Justice Gorsuch writes a 40-page dissent.
Is that a lot?
That's a lot in a case, you know, I mean, it's significant here, mm-hmm. in which he's essentially saying what he has said when he was just a judge of the appeals court, which is that he's going to be very, very, very skeptical about the delegation of authority to administrative agencies. He's going to look very, very carefully at that. And what's interesting here is Justice Kavanaugh disqualifies himself because oral argument took place before he was confirmed.
Okay.
But Justice Alito is telescoping to Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Give me the next case.
To do what?
To find that the delegation to an administrative agency is unconstitutional. And he says that essentially, if a majority of this court were willing to reconsider the approach we've taken for 84 years, 84 years. I'll support that. But because a majority is not willing to do it, it would be freakish to single this out. What he's saying is, Kavanaugh, when you're on the court, I will join you and Gorsuch, and we will have a majority to reconsider this doctrine. And that will have a significant impact because agencies' authority to function will be undermined by this kind of analysis. Congress can never legislate in the kind of detail that administrative agencies can. Today, the EPA, for example, there's a challenge. The EPA is taking the position under the Trump administration that it doesn't have the authority to regulate clean air.
But that's what EPA does.
That's right. Because essentially that this goes beyond its powers to regulate, that we're making choices that are functional, that are the functional equivalent of the kinds of choices that a legislature should make. If the Supreme Court affirms that, it will gut the administrative state.
So we're getting telegraphing of a potential 84-year reversal.
That's right.
Okay, that's a lot bigger than what the case sounds
like. That's right. No, they're talking to one another. Gorsuch is talking to
signaling.
Alito. Yes, that's
very
right.
Interesting. All right. So listen, I do want to get to this other case quickly. In a 7-2 decision, the court allowed a 40-foot cross honoring deceased soldiers from World War I to stand on state property in Maryland, saying the cross didn't violate the First Amendment ban on government-established religion. Justice Ginsburg filed the dissenting opinion quite vociferously, I think, and Justice Sotomayor joined. Again, let's focus really clearly. What is the implication? This isn't really about a cross on a hill.
Right. It's a question of how far the court will go to second-guess the use of religious symbols in public settings. And what the majority says in this situation, I believe that Justice Alito wrote the majority here, he says that this was essentially, although it was a cross, it essentially had a secular meaning, that it was had a historical and secular meaning to commemorate the war dead, and therefore was not erected for religious purposes and didn't have a religious impact.
So the cross had stopped being a religious cross.
That's right.
At some point.
That's right. Justice Ginsburg, together with Justice Sotomayor, it isn't enough to say that she registered a dissent. She read her dissent. And reading the dissent means something. And she said that it doesn't matter how long this has been in place. The cross does not have a secular meaning. She harked back to issues after World War II where Jewish soldiers did not want to be, you know, the families of Jewish soldiers did not want them to be buried under a cross. And so she's saying there is no secular meaning here, that the cross should not stand.
So it's not like there's some sort of spiritual half-life that eventually spends off and then the cross doesn't
That's
have...
That's a great way of talking about it, right.
Okay.
But essentially, the issue is not this particular case because the majority reconfigured the symbolism of the cross to say it didn't mean what a cross usually means. And the dissent is saying, oh, yes, it does.
Right.
But that's a battleground that we'll be fighting forever.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Okay, before I let you go, we're still waiting on a number of other cases. This is the big time. We're going to clearly have you join us to talk about those. But Department of Commerce, North Carolina, Maryland, gerrymandering cases, others. Does any of today's rulings signal anything to you about what's yet to come in those other rulings?
No, at this point you can't. They're very unique. I mean, I think the one to watch is the gerrymandering case because that will actually have an impact on the composition of Congress.
For maybe even 2020.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge and now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for being
here. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we talk Women's World Cup. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and we are talking sports. Team USA is taking on Sweden right now in the Women's World Cup. I see that the USA is ahead 1-0.
Already?
Over Sweden. Actually, nearing the end of the first half, so we're into it now. With us, our WBUR Sports and Society reporter, Shira Springer. Hi, Shira.
Hi.
It is time. And also here is WBUR and NPR sports commentator, Bill Littlefield. Bill, hello.
Hello. I think there should be an emeritus but thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm going to call you Emeritus Bill for the rest of this interview. All right. Let's talk Team USA and Sweden. There is some history behind this matchup. Listeners, you might recall, 2016 Summer Olympics, Sweden defeated the Americans in the quarterfinals. But U.S. forward Kristen Press says the team is looking forward.
The team feels very different from the group that we took to the Olympics. But at the same time, despite the fact that it's been 3 years, you don't forget the taste in your mouth when you fail and when you lose in a world championship. And I think that there's a little bit of that that will definitely act as motivation. And you always play to win and to never have that feeling again.
So rivalry makes it more fun. This is the last game of the group stage. So even if the USA loses, they're locked in. But listening to that tape and from what you've seen of the World Cup so far, is there some urgency for the US to win this game, Shira?
Well, I think you want to go into the knockout round, which is the next series of games, on a winning streak. You don't want to go in with a loss. It sort of leaves a bad taste in your mouth and maybe, you know, causes you to question your confidence a little bit. So I think you always want to have a winning streak heading into, you know, a one and done situation, a situation where one loss and you're out of the tournament. But I don't think there's any real sense of urgency because it's an interesting scenario for the U.S. If they win and win their group, they are on a path to face France in the quarterfinals. So that's a little bit down the road. But France is one of the powerhouse teams in the tournament and, of course, has home field advantage, so to speak, in their home. The tournament's being played in their home country. So there has been some questioning. Does the U.S. want to perhaps not play Sweden as strongly as they might so they could avoid facing France in the quarterfinals? But as you might expect, the women on the U.S. team are like, heck no. We want the toughest competition we can get. We want to show that we won this thing by going through the toughest teams to get the title if they end up winning the title. I don't want to presume anything because it is a tough tournament.
Well,
there
you
is
don't want
some
to jinx
parity.
Anybody.
That's true. And
no
there is jinxing. There is more parity in this tournament than there has been in past tournaments.
All right, Bill, so let's talk about that parity. So should we be expecting other 13-0 blowouts, or is it going to tighten up now and we're going to see really close
the latter
matches?
I don't know how many matches will be really close. Soccer's a kind of a, as somebody once said, you know, it's any game with a ball in it is an unpredictable game. Balls tend to bounce in peculiar ways. But I don't think you're going to see another 13-0 game. You may see some 4-0 games.
Which in the world of soccer that's usually what a blowout
whitewash,
looks
absolutely,
like.
Absolutely, yeah. No question. It's interesting the way Shira put it. I agree 100% that it's better to go in to the next stage 3-0 than 3-1 or 3-0-1, but 2-0-1. But the kind of operative knowledge, the way that people talk about it in soccer is you go into the group stage with the goal of getting out of the group stage, and it doesn't really matter how you do it as long as you do it and you get to the next part of the tournament. That having been said, obviously there is baggage in this game, and the U.S. would rather beat Sweden than not.
And not carry that trail behind them. All right, so that 13-0 reference I made was the game that the U.S. played against Thailand, and I really want to talk about this. The U.S. team faced some criticism for the way they celebrated those goals, spinning around, kicking heels in
the
air.
Here comes the fun part.
Sliding, let's do this. This happened over a week ago.
By the way, we're getting an in-studio demonstration here.
Yeah.
That's right. My arms are up. Folks are still talking about this. Happened more than a week ago, but this still chatter beyond just sports circles. U.S. forward Alex Morgan, who scored 5 goals during that game, had some words for the critics.
These are goals that we have dreamt of our entire life. I mean, I'm going to celebrate Mal Pugh's goal. I'm going to celebrate Sam Lewis and Roosevelt. This is their first World Cup, and I'm so proud of them. And so I couldn't have dreamt of scoring 5 goals in a World Cup. So it's incredible for us all. And I'm happy just ignoring those comments.
So there are two things at play here, and I'm going to ask you both about both of them. The first thing at play is just the question of sportsmanship. From a sportsmanship perspective, Shira, did they celebrate too much?
No.
Tell me why.
For precisely the reasons you heard there, you know, for some players, this was their first World Cup goals. It was their first World Cup game. This is the biggest stage for women's soccer in the world. They have been working for 4 years to get to this point. They deserve to celebrate how they want to celebrate. Goals are a big deal. They are tough to come by. Even if it didn't look that way against Thailand, they are still tough to come by. And players should be allowed to celebrate how they want to celebrate. And we shouldn't be policing how, you know, these celebrations. To me, that is so wrong.
But a lot of sports police celebrations.
Yes. That's an interesting point, because the NFL finally got so discouraged with the end zone celebrations that they made rules about how long those celebrations
and the NFL is poorer
the right thing
for
to do,
it,
right?
And with baseball, Shira and I were speaking about this before. There are lots of old traditional sports writers and not so old traditional sports writers who are very upset when somebody hits a home run, drops the bat, and watches the ball leave the park before he, you know, deigns to run around the bases.
Well, the pitcher's going to clock that person the next time they're at bat.
Maybe. But there are a lot of people who just regard that as poor sportsmanship. So I don't think it's entirely a gender issue, but it is also not – you can't separate it from what the criticism of females has been, female athletes particularly. If a female is loud, she's shrill. If a female is angry, she's out of control. This is something that obviously goes on way beyond sports. And the upside of this whole discussion, it seems to me, is people are talking about this and they are saying, hey, can you legitimately criticize female athletes in a different way than you criticize male athletes? And the answer, it seems to me, obviously, is no, you can't. If you want to say it's bad sportsmanship, well, then you got to bring in all the bad sportsmanship on the male side in various other sports and talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to say these are just elite athletes, very excited about playing at the elite level, Morgan's comment indicated, some of these women have never been on this stage before. They've never had hundreds of thousands of people watching them play soccer before. Of course they're excited, and of course they're going to celebrate. And I think you have to have a certain amount of understanding for that.
Shira.
Yeah, and I think Bill brings up great points about the larger context in which this is all playing out. And I think another part of that larger context is the larger sports context, which is throughout the history of women's sports, there has been this emphasis and this preference, unfortunately, that female athletes look feminine, and there's been criticism when they aren't feminine
enough.
It's
the whole ladylike layer.
Exactly. I mean, and this is not, you know, sort of some distant past. You know, the women on Brazil's national soccer team have had to fight with the leaders of the Brazilian Federation, you know, and there have been comments about the women not looking feminine enough and the men, you know, the leaders of that federation making sexist comments. So there's a whole, I don't want to say subtext, but a whole history here of particularly men in powers of position in soccer being critical of the way women look, the way women behave. I mean, we were talking before about the movie in a league of their own, that baseball movie where you saw
the women's baseball teams during World War II.
Exactly, getting etiquette classes. And so
I think about Serena Williams versus John McEnroe in tennis.
Exactly.
He was a golden boy for being a brat, and she gets in trouble every time she yells on the court.
Exactly.
That's a little bit skewed, I think, because there were numbers of us who regarded John McEnroe as a magnificent tennis player who couldn't control himself and acted like a jerk.
Fair enough.
I could dig out some of the things I wrote back in the day. But you're right that Serena Williams came in for more criticism when she went after the official than a male player would have under the same circumstance. What I think of when some of the points that Shira has made, FIFA not that long ago
said Sepp Blatter, the
greatest improvement that could be made in women's soccer is that they play in shorter shorts.
Yeah.
And he thought it was funny.
Yeah, yeah. Not only do I think he thought it was funny, but I think he was also pretty serious about it.
He meant it and thought it was
funny. Yeah, so in that context, this takes on a whole other meaning.
Aren't women already making more money, earning more money for soccer than men. So isn't that just extra profoundly?
They're not earning more
money.
Raising more revenue, for the sport.
Yes. In fact,
we know they're not earning more money.
Yes, there's the equal pay fight. But, you know, I think there was figures that were just released that appeared in the Wall Street Journal that over the last 3 or 4 years since the last Women's World Cup, the women's team has earned more revenue.
Yeah, it has to do to some extent with the fact that the women's team tends to stay in the tournament longer than the men's team.
It also helps when you're actually in the tournament, considering the men didn't make the 2018
qualifying for men's tournament. Right. Counts as being in the tournament.
All right. Before we start getting callers when we didn't even ask for any, I think I'm going to move us on to a new subject. It's a much more sobering subject. I want to turn to the latest news on David Ortiz. Authorities in the Dominican Republic said yesterday that his shooting earlier this month in the DR, they're saying it was a case of mistaken identity. Here is prosecutor Jean-Alain Rodriguez speaking through an interpreter to say that the intended target was a man named David Fernandez, who was sitting at the same table in the bar where Ortiz was shot.
Because of the way that everything was placed, that the pants that David Fernandez were white, the same are the ones that David Ortiz was wearing.
Okay, there are a lot of rumors swirling around. Authorities say the attack was ordered by a drug trafficker who hired hitmen to kill Fernandez, who is his cousin. Shira, the eye rolling during that tape was pretty impressive, so let's go to you.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to the press conference yesterday, and, you know, the Attorney General for the Dominican Republic went to great lengths to say, you know, we have evidence, we have scientific proof of all this, but this really strains credibility, that this is a case of mistaken identity, that they, you know, they weren't after David Ortiz, but after someone else. Listen, David Ortiz is one of the most recognizable athletes in the world. He's one of the most beloved and recognized athletes in the Dominican Republic. And not only that, he's a fairly large human being, and with a, I would say, describe it as a very distinct silhouette. So whether you are behind him or in front of him, he's very easily recognizable. And if you watch the video of the shooting, it took place at extraordinarily close range. The shooter was maybe 2 or 3 feet behind David Ortiz.
I'm sensing you find this credible.
No, and I'm sorry.
Me too. I'm kind of getting that impression, too. Yeah.
It just, you know, you have evidence, you have scientific evidence. I mean, I'd like to see just the wearing the same clothes. It doesn't pass sort of the smell test for me.
All right, so we've got about 30 seconds left. Bill, I'm going to shift gears one more time to basketball.
Uh-oh.
We've got the NBA draft tonight, but the big news is the Celtics are now looking at losing two players. Al Horford, who's the latest to be expected to leave, along with Kyrie Irving. What does this suggest for the season coming up this fall? And, you know, 20 seconds.
Well, a lot of my friends who are Celtics fans suggest that it couldn't be better. That the best thing to do would be, like in a Scrabble game.
To get rid of Kyrie?
If it's a Scrabble game where you have lousy, you turn in all your tiles and get new ones.
So Kyrie is the Q, or is the Q tile.
You got a
you
Z,
think the
you got a couple
a good
of X's.
Idea.
I don't have any idea how this is all going to turn out. I think talking about basketball in June is a fool's errand. I hope for the best.
All right. But WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Emeritus WBUR and NPR Sports commentator Bill Littlefield, thanks.
Great pleasure.
Finally today, we are going to go out on some different music. Here's Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell.
Yeah, opening at Boston's Aganis Arena this week is Cirque du Soleil's Corteo. And in addition to all of the acrobats, the ringmaster of the show, Mr. Loyal, is played by a world-class whistler. Geert Chatru is from the Netherlands, and he won the World Whistling Championships in 2004, 2005, and in 2008.
So I didn't know we had a World Whistling Championship. What does he perform?
He performs basically everything. You heard Sweet Caroline at the top, but he's also got this wide repertoire of music he loves. When I spoke with him, he mentioned everything from Jimi Hendrix to the music of the Renaissance. And he actually won one of his world championships with the American National Anthem. Here's a little bit of that. Plus, he also performed his rendition of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, which he actually does on the show for me as well. Let's hear that.
So, this is awesome. It's awesome. So he's really approaching whistling as a musician, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what he calls himself. You know, for him, whistling, it's his instrument, just like a piccolo would be or a flute.
I did a flute concert by Mozart, whistling it instead of using a flute. And of course, it looks really weird, you know, a big guy producing all this high notes. But if you hit every note and you hit it right, then people understand it's real music.
All right, we have to have more. So do you have something for us to go out with?
Of course I do. So here's something that people might have as their ringtone. It's from the last movement of Johann Sebastian Bach's Suite No. 2 in B minor, and I really loved his rendition.
That is Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell, and it's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sitterick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.